This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Hi, this is Spencer Graves with Bill Claus, your host for this episode of Radioactive Magazine at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Tonight's broadcast features two issues. First, we'll hear a recorded interview discussing the 1967 Israeli attack on the USS Liberty 50 years ago this Thursday. This will be followed by some comments on the Kansas City, Missouri School District from Tom Love, who's been active in trying to improve the schools. We will first hear Margot Patterson's interview recorded last Friday with Bryce Lockwood, who was on the ship when he was attacked, and former Representative Pete McCloskey of California.
This June marks the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War between Israel and its Arab neighbors. One of the lesser-known and very mysterious incidents in that war was the Israeli attack on a U.S. naval intelligence ship stationed in international waters in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. 34 American seamen lost their lives in the attack on the USS Liberty, and 171 were injured. Israel later said it was a case of mistaken identity, apologized for the attack, and paid compensation to the survivors and the families of the dead. But there are still many questions about the assault. Why did Israel attack a ship that was flying the American flag? Why did the White House twice call back U.S. fighter planes sent to defend the USS Liberty? Why were so many essential facts about the attack never revealed to the American public? Here to talk about some of these facts is Bryce Lockwood, a retired Marine sergeant and Russian language expert who was serving on the USS Liberty when it was attacked 50 years ago, and who will be giving a talk in Kansas City June 22nd. Joining him on the line is retired Congressman Pete McCloskey, U.S. Congress from 1967 to 1983. He got to know one of the Israeli attackers on the USS Liberty several years ago. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
For listeners who are not familiar with the attack on the USS Liberty, could you briefly recap what happened that day?
Margot, the USS Liberty was the finest and most modern intelligence collection ship in the entire world in 1967. News was normally up and down the west coast of Africa, listening in on the communications between the Soviet Union, Cuba, and the newly independent colonies. As war appeared to be imminent between the Israelis and the United Arab Republic, which consisted of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, the Egyptians had massed troops in the Sinai Peninsula away from Israel. They were no threat to Israel. They were all in defensive positions. Their tanks were dug in. Their troops were dug in. But there is a school of thought which goes along the lines dating back to the 19th century that amassing troops on the border of another country is tantamount to a declaration of war. Israel actually initiated hostilities, I believe, on June the 5th. The USS Liberty arrived on station on June the 7th. On the morning of June the 8th, we were overflown on about eight different occasions by Israeli aircraft. The aircraft would circle us very closely. There were occasions where off-duty sailors were sunning themselves on the deck. That is anathema to Muslims sunning themselves. So it was pretty obvious that these were friendly people that were on board the ship. That was throughout the morning, beginning about 6 o'clock in the morning for several hours. We had a drill general quarters about noontime, local time, around 2 o'clock p.m. Suddenly, there was a very loud noise of explosions topside of the ship. I was in the afterbirthing compartment. I dropped what I was doing and immediately ran for my GQ station. GQ alarm sounded, and actually, it was the wrong alarm. We didn't realize who was attacking us. The Israelis were using unmarked aircraft, which is a violation of international law. The attack lasted officially for about 75 minutes. After the initial air raids, the Israelis were using heat-seeking missiles, which destroyed all of our transmitting antennas, at least two attacks with napalm on the topside decks. So the outside area of the ship on the starboard side was engulfed in flames. we were essentially defenseless. We only had a grand total of 4 50 caliber machine guns for defense. So that was the only defense that we had.
When did you realize it was Israeli planes that were attacking the ship?
Actually, we did not realize who it was. As I mentioned earlier, the Israelis were using unmarked aircraft, which is a violation of international law. We did not know who was attacking us until 3 motor torpedo boats appeared on the scene. They were flying the Israeli flag. One of our officers of the deck was of Jewish ancestry. It's my understanding that he burst into tears when he saw the Star of David flag flying from the torpedo boats that were attacking us. The Israelis fired 5 torpedoes at us. 4 of those torpedoes missed. One struck just forward of the bridge below the waterline. Most of us communications technicians were below the waterline. The torpedo ripped a 40-foot hole in the starboard side of the ship. There were 25 sailors that were killed in the torpedo explosion, in addition to 9 that were killed in the air attacks topside. The Israelis claimed that they mistook us for an Egyptian ship, the El Kassir. El Kassir was a World War I horse transport ship. Her profile was considerably different from ours. She was considerably less in tonnage and in size. Egyptian ships are painted black with hull markings in Arabic script in gray. U.S. ships are painted gray with hull markings highlighted and silhouetted in bright white colors, silhouetted with gray and black, so they cannot be mistaken. The El Kassir was waiting to be cut up for scrap and had not been to sea for 20 years. The Israelis claimed that they were being shelled from the sea. Actually, what had happened, they had captured an entire Egyptian brigade, somewhere in excess of 850 Egyptian troops. They were in the process of destroying the ammunition stores, which the Egyptians had, and it was actually Israel's own troops that were destroying the captured ammunition that were causing the hullabaloo of loud explosions. Certainly was not any ship at sea. They claimed they had been shelled from the sea, and there was only one ship out there, which was USS Liberty, so therefore it must have been a warship. The hull markings on Liberty were GTR5. These are huge letters and numbers. The number 5 was over 8 feet tall. GTR stands for General Technical Research, which means Liberty was a non-combatant. By international agreements, you do not fire at non-combatants. Fire between ships at sea is limited to warships. Liberty was no warship. She was a non-combatant.
Okay, we interrupt this broadcast for a very important message for our sponsors, you. KKFI is listener-sponsored radio. It relies on contributions from people like you so we can pay our bills and stay on the air. To do that, you can call 888-931-0901, or you can go to kkfi.org and click the donate button in the upper right. I'd like to tell you briefly about what brought me to KKFI today. I was raised on a farm in northwest Kansas, arch right-wing America. I spent 6 years in the U.S. Air Force during the Vietnam War. I developed a habit of asking, how do you know that? That question led me to get a PhD in statistics and do research on all kinds of issues from political science to public policy. Regarding the latter, public policy, I eventually concluded that progress on every substantive issue I can think of is blocked because every plausible countermeasure threatens someone with substantive control over the media. It doesn't matter if you are concerned about global warming or the deterioration of public schools or the international, the Islamic State or the war on terror or whatever your issue is, we need honest media. We do not need media that must of necessity pull their punches to avoid displeasing advertisers. That brought me to KKFI because you can hear things on 90.1 FM that must of necessity be that would otherwise displease advertisers on commercial media. They simply do not make money biting the hands that feed them. So I hope you will call 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org and click the donate button near the upper right. Bill, would you like to add something?
Yeah, I would. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in to Radioactive Magazine. And those of you that have been listening know that we have some thank you gifts that you can get for donating at different levels. At $90, you can get the new KKFI T-shirt. At the $75 level, you can get the Richard Wolf, a flash drive with the Richard Wolf speech that he gave when he did a fundraiser for KKFI. And I'm going to throw in a special one-time only, and this is the first time it's been offered. I have a bunch of glasses that you can use for the upcoming solar eclipse on August the 21st. You can't look at the sun during the eclipse unless you're wearing protective glasses, and I'll include a pair of these glasses to anybody that donates any amount now. So give us a call. 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901. And now, back to our program.
This is Margo Patterson, and if you're just tuning in, we're at KKFI Radio, and I'm talking to Bryce Lockwood, the survivor of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in 1967, and Representative Pete McCloskey. Tell us about the U.S. government's response to the Israeli attack, both during the attack and then afterwards.
The morning of June the 9th, Bobby Kennedy and Senator Jacob Javits held a news conference on the steps of the U.S. Capitol and said, well, we know it was a mistake because our ally Israel did it. But excuse me, every protocol in international law that was designed to prevent such an attack was violated by the Israelis on June the 8th.
I want to get back to the U.S. reaction a little bit later, but I think Congressman McCloskey is on the line. Congressman McCloskey, I know that you got to know one of the Israeli soldiers involved in the attack on the USS Liberty. Could you talk a little bit about the circumstances in which you got to know this man and what you learned from him about the attack?
Yes, I had left the Congress in 1982, and it was, I think, about 10 years later, I got a call, Jim Ennis, who had been the guy that put the flag up on Liberty, and he'd written a book called The Assault on the Liberty. In any event, he had had a call from a young woman in New York City who was worried about her boyfriend, or at least a man who had been an Israeli pilot, and who wanted to get either federal witness protection or the publicity of an appearance possibly before Congress to tell his story of the attack on the Liberty. Well, I was in California, but I had a former Marine that had served under me, wounded in the Korean War, and he and an attorney went to see this fellow in the jail. They talked to him because I wanted to get an analysis of, and their view was whether he was real or a fake, just trying to get out of jail. He was under a felony charge from embezzlement that carried a 5 to 15 year penalty. And they talked to him at length, and they concluded about 90% of the chance that he was real. He was young, he was a vigorous guy in good health, very smart guy. And I'll read to you from their report to me, which they sent back after meeting with him. He said he was the executive officer on the flight, that they circled over the Liberty several times, that he saw both black and white sailors on the deck, so it had to be an American ship, that there was a small American flag at first, but they ran up a much bigger American flag. He reported to his base that the ship was American, but was told to attack anyway. He refused to fire and flew back to his base. He went to his home or apartment, but was subsequently taken into custody. He mentioned the name Sharon at some time in a discussion. He said he loved his country, Israel, but was afraid to go back. As a result of that letter, I found that he is later transferred to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, the federal penitentiary there, which is not a maximum security penitentiary. And so I met with him in the consent of the warden in the room there at Leavenworth, and I found him to be a very intelligent man, and very possibly he was absolutely correct in what he had previously told the lawyer and my Marine friend. And he was looking forward to getting out. I believe it was in November of 95 or 6 that he was to get out of his term, but he was terribly worried that when he got out, he might be picked up by the Israeli government and taken back to Israel and tried and executed for treason for telling the story. He was interested in a congressional hearing at that time, any event that would give the publicity and perhaps save his life. He asked me when I left that prison that first time, would I call an Israeli a colonel who was then going through the war college at Leavenworth, but he'd met him at a synagogue, or he'd heard about, or knew he was an Israeli colonel going through the war college, and would I call him when I went out of town? Well, I did. I stopped in the phone booth and called this colonel at the number he'd given me in a very Israeli heavy accent, came on the phone. I told him about this guy, Eamon Tov, that wanted to see him, and would he call on him? Then I left. A few weeks later, I got an anguished letter from Tov. He was now down at the Springfield, Missouri penitentiary, and I called a friend who knew about the Springfield penitentiary in the federal system, and he laughed. He said, that's the icebox. That's where they put people that they don't want anybody to find very easily. They're out of circulation, can't talk to the press. Later, I got another letter from Tov, and he said they were putting swastikas on his wall, and they knew he was Jewish or Israeli, and the prison guards were anti-Israel, or at least anti-Jewish. He couldn't get kosher food, and would I call the B'nai B'rith director in St. Louis, and he gave me his name, a man named Anderman. And I called Anderman, and I said, can you get some help over to Springfield and help Adnan Tov, name is A-D-N-A-N-T-O-V, against this anti-Semitism? And the B'nai B'rith director was kind of funny. He said, oh, are you that McCloskey? Because he knew I'd been the attorney for the Liberty Crew, which had caused a little consternation in the Jewish community. They always thought that honoring the Liberty would be anti-Semitic and bring a criticism on Israel. In any event, the rabbi went down there, and Tov later wrote me that things were better, but that he was getting out in November, and he was very worried if they transferred him to New York, they'd turn him over to the Israeli government. Well, I made a note. His release date was November 18th, and I made a note to try to contact him or contact the federal authorities, but when I did, there was no record. He just disappeared. On the 18th, there's no record that he arrived in federal custody in New York. There's no arrival, no record that he was given any to the Israelis or that he even existed. And I'm afraid that what happened was very possibly that our government, in its alliances with Israel, did turn him over to the Israelis and that they did transfer him back to Israel and that he very well may have been the subject of a secret court-martial and executed. I've heard from several former Israelis that happens with traitors. There's a secret court-martial and their execution. But that's all I can tell you, except that he wasn't exactly a likable guy, but he was a very smooth customer, and he was a very competent guy, and his story made sense. Later on, another Israeli defector named Victor Ostrowski, who had left the Mossad and written a book about deception, by way of deception, and the Israeli government tried to suppress it, but our courts ruled that it could be printed, and it sold 2 million copies, and it described the Israeli operations and the Mossad, and in particular, this man said that, of course, the Israelis knew that the Liberty was a U.S. ship. They had a big war room and a big picture of the ocean with all the ships of the various navies, the U.S. and the Egyptian and their fleet, any Russian fleets, and they knew precisely that it was. And one thing Tov said to me, it was not ordered by the Israeli government. It was ordered by one man in the Israeli government, and the name Sharon came up as perhaps the man that ordered the attack on the Liberty. But that's all I can tell you, except that the Liberty had more casualties than any ship since World War II. I think had a crew of 290 or something, 194 killed or wounded, 34 killed, one of them who was Jewish. But that's about all I can tell you, except that the description of what they did, machine gunning the lifeboats, it's clear that they intended to wipe out the Liberty and leave no survivors, and that the Captain McGonagall was able to limp back to to Malta and save the ship, and then the Navy just put a tight security lid. They had dispersed the crew, ordered everybody not to talk about it or they'd be subject to court-martial. I'm not very proud of the Navy and their treatment of the Liberty crew.
Gentlemen, I understand that most of the survivors and many people in our government feel that there was never a full and credible investigation. Why?
No, there never was an investigation, although Admiral Tom Moore, who became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Nixon years, he told me personally that he knew it was a deliberate attack. And there was an American ambassador lately who was listening in on the Israeli transmissions who confirmed that the Israelis knew that they were attacking. And it was believed, I think, by our government that they did so because they couldn't afford a radio transmission that would order their final part of the Six-Day War, the attack on the Golan Heights. And they couldn't have, they said, well, we'll take a chance, we'll knock an American ship down rather than give the Arabs any advance knowledge that we're going to attack the Golan Heights. But the real reason is that Lyndon Johnson was terribly afraid of his Jewish constituency, and this has been true in the Congress. Congressmen never want to vote against Israel if they can help it in any way because of the power of the Jewish community in the United States, which many of whom believe that they owed Israel a duty of protecting Israel from whatever they can do in the United States to prevent bad word coming out about it. And, of course, the word of the liberty has been, their people have been suppressed. They go to American Legion conventions and nobody will let them discuss their story. It's a tragedy, and this happened in 1967, 50 years ago. The first president to recognize that they were entitled to respect and honor was my friend George H.W. Bush, who invited the Liberty Crew to the White House, and they had a barbecue for them in the Rose Garden, and I think that was 25 years ago.
I have just one last question, and this goes to Bryce. Bryce, you've spent 50 years trying to learn more about the attack that you were subject to June 8, 1967. What are some of the key questions that remain mysterious to you, and what keeps you pursuing this investigation?
We believe the attack was deliberate. We believe all the evidence show it was. And here we are 50 years later. Many of the attackers that were involved have already passed off the scene. Most of the survivors are getting very elderly now, and we're passing off the scene. At the very least, for historic purposes, the full truth should come out about the attack on the Liberty. There are some of us crewmen that believe there was something much more sinister involved. The possibility that we were set up by our own president to be a sacrificial lamb to get us involved in a armed conflict with Egypt and the powers of the United Arab Republic back in 1967. The Israelis, if there was such an agreement between the Johnson administration and the Israeli government, it needs to be public.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us. And just a reminder that Bryce Lockwood will be speaking about the attack on the Liberty June 22nd at 7 p.m. at VFW Post 7397 at 9550 Flum Road in Lenexa.
And for more information, for a repeat of what Margo just said, announcing the June 22nd event, you can go to the description of this episode of Radioactive Magazine on kkfi.org. We now have with us Tom Love, a former Kansas State legislator who got interested in the problems of the Kansas City, Missouri schools a few years ago and has been devoting part of his time since to researching the problems and how they might be fixed. Tom, can you briefly summarize for our listeners what you've learned and what you think concerned citizens might do to help improve the quality of education in Kansas City, Missouri school district?
Well, I've learned quite a bit. I was totally surprised at all the different rules and regulations that the district wasn't complying with under state law. For example, we were starting children a year before it was even legal in Missouri. So one out of six children were really not old enough to be in first grade. We had funding for summer school that was available that the superintendent wasn't aware of. And so we went from 1,500 students to 7,500 students attending summer school. There's also things like a literacy law that we weren't complying with. And that law said that the students were supposed to receive after-school tutoring in fourth grade and summer school, mandatory, but that was to continue for fifth and sixth grade and on through as up to seniors in high school if they haven't completed fourth grade reading level, which is what's considered functionally literate. So I was really surprised, and I think that's due primarily to superintendents coming in from out of state, bringing in different administrators, and they're not aware of state laws. The other thing that really shocked me was the federal funding that's available for the children in the district and in all low-income schools across the country. It's called Title I. And in that funding, they're supposed to provide reading help to the children, particularly in K through second grade, where children learn to read. And unfortunately, the district wasn't spending that money for the literacy part of it. And the literacy problem was so bad, or is still bad at this point, compared to what it could be. But at the time, there was only about 27% of the students reading on grade level at third grade. We actually had, at the end of first grade, we had 30% of the students that were at kindergarten level, and they were automatically promoted to second grade. So some serious literacy issues. I actually found out that 40% of the students entering Central Middle School at seventh grade had not completed fourth grade reading level, and at the time there wasn't any help for them. But that changed, and I was successful with that by bringing the information to the superintendent and the school boards on once-a-month meetings on Wednesday nights, and you're allowed 3 minutes. And I just brought those issues, kept bringing, repeating it. Sometimes it might take six times to get them to say comply with the literacy law, and then it got implemented once they were sure that hey, this is really the law. So it was a slow process, but well worth it.
So that's very interesting, Tom. So what would you suggest that people might, concerned citizens might do if they wanted to get more involved in trying to improve their local school district?
Well, one of the things that really shocked me was, and this is 5.5 years ago when the school district had lost its accreditation, I thought there would be a lot of parents there the following month when it was a public comment was a time was available. And I was the only person there to speak. And that really was shocking to me.
So just showing up, right?
getting involved, getting interested, and just being there, and then trying to identify the weaknesses and bring solutions to the administration. We even have problems with providing enough recesses for students. This is really shocking. I just talked what do I know about education, but talking to teachers about it from other districts and whatever, that making suggestions, and it's effective.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Tom. We're basically out of time, and I want to thank you for listening. There, I want to remind all our listeners that you can get more information about both the Kansas City Schools and about the USS Liberty by going to the episode description for this episode at kkfi.org. And there are links in that episode description that will take you to more details, discussion of improving schools on Wikiversity, and a link to, as I said, the June 22nd presentation at the VFW Post in Lenexa, Kansas.